It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You've heard about the Happy Fork, right? The invention from Happy Labs, which creates happy science. This electronic fork is supposed to make you healthier and thinner. Now, here's the deal. When the fork thinks that you've eaten too much, it vibrates. When the fork thinks that you're eating too fast, LED lights go off. A great help with overeating, right? Yeah. Great potential for being stomped to bits by eaters driven over the edge by flashing lights and vibrations? Definitely. I just wonder what their return policy is. Well, stick around for much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, we may have an undiscovered culinary destination for you today, Poland. Anne Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and journalist who has covered Poland and Eastern Europe since 1988. Then she was reporting on the disintegration of communist Poland. Well, Poland is now her second home, specifically in what was a wreck of an old farmhouse that her family's restored. She's lived through Poland's amazing culinary renaissance. She and her friend and fellow journalist, Danielle Crittenden, have written From a Polish Country House Kitchen, 90 Recipes for the Ultimate Comfort Food. Anne, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Anne, how did you come to have a home in Poland?
In the 1980s, when communism was really on its last legs, my husband and his parents bought a ruined manor house. And when I married him with the ruined manor house and with the understanding that we were going to renovate it, which we did. And it took about 10 years longer than it was supposed to do. But it was a real learning experience, not only because I'd never renovated a destroyed manor house before, but because we did it in the 90s when Poland was also renovating itself. So you learned a lot about how Poland was changing while doing it.
So your husband was born and raised in Poland.
My husband was born and raised in Poland and lived there, went to high school there, left when he was 18, which is when Poland, the Polish communist declared martial law. He actually got political asylum in England and went to university in England. But he is Polish and his parents are Polish.
Now, what did communism do to Polish cuisine?
Communism did not destroy Polish cuisine, but it made Polish cuisine's life very difficult. One of the features of communism that was one of the most difficult for everybody, but particularly for people who need to cook and feed families, were shortages. It was a very inefficient economy. It was very bad at distributing things. It meant that it was very hard to get fresh vegetables. It was unless you happened to live near somebody with a garden or if you had a garden.
Right.
It was hard to get fresh meat. It was very difficult to get hold of products, and so Polish food became by definition much. It lost many of its historical flavors and its historical variety. And this was particularly true, of course, in Polish restaurants, which were famously bad in this period. And, and the other famous thing about them was they often didn't have anything that was on the menu. So you'd go in and say, you'd order something. They'd say, sorry, we haven't got that. And what do you have? Well, you can have a piece of fried pork with rice. And that was the stereotype. People did cook at home, and some of my fondest memories of Poland in that period. I was in Poland in the 80s, and I do remember the collapse just before the collapse of communism. That was that people nevertheless managed somehow to organize food so that they were able to welcome guests and produce really sometimes rather amazing food in their own homes. But it required effort. It required contacts. I remember that in Warsaw, all of my friends had. There was a veal lady, and all of my friends had contact with the veal lady, and she would come to your house and deliver veal. But you had to have it was a sort of black market arrangement.
You had to know.
You had to sort of know somebody in order to be able to do it. And so, but people did make those kinds of arrangements, and they did eat well in their houses.
So, I realize this is a cuisine that, unless you're in one of the parts of the country where there's a Polish community, we know nothing about Polish cuisine. What makes Polish cuisine Polish? I mean, what don't we know? And can you do that in less than an hour?
You can do it in less than an hour. Although, in my view, the best thing about Polish food are the soups. And the great thing about soup, as anybody who makes soup knows, is that it's what you make on a day when you have to be at home anyway, and you don't want to sit over the stove all day, but you want to throw things in, then let it simmer for an hour, and then come back and throw in some pepper and let it simmer for another hour.
Mm-hmm.
But Polish food is – it has some flavors that we're not used to and that I think aren't well known in our country. Sour foods, sweet and sour foods are a major part of the cuisine. And so sour soups, there's a famous Polish – it's kind of sour rye bread soup called żurek. Another the summer version of that is something called chodnik, which is a cold beetroot soup that you make with either yogurt or, if you are even better, with kefir. It mixes the sweet of the beets with a little bit of the sour milk of sour yogurt or kefir.
Yeah.
And it is extremely good, and it's exactly what you want to eat on a hot day. It's very, very refreshing and at the same time light, and it's got, you know, fresh vegetables in it.
So what do you love to cook when you're in Poland?
Probably my favorite, my standby dish, and this will sound more exotic than it really is a venison stew. I make it with dates, and I make it with fennel.
Ah.
And it steams together so that you have a little bit of sweetness from the meat. You have some crunchiness from the fennel. It's made in it with a wine marinade as well. It's also, although this one is adjusted a little bit, it's not classic Polish cuisine. It is very common in Poland to cook meat with fruit. You very often see pork cooked with plums, or you see meat stewed with fruit, and that's a very common combination. I think people make use not only of their fruit trees in the summer, but they make use of jams and preserved fruit, and they cook that with meat very often in the winter. And venison stew is one of these things. You know, you can put it on in the morning. You can then put it in the oven, and it cooks for 2 hours. And if you happen to get distracted because you're working on a paragraph and you need to finish it, and if you leave it for an extra 20 minutes, it's okay. That's so it works perfectly with my life, and it's something everybody in my family likes to eat. When we're lucky to have friends who hunt, and so we have quite a lot of venison usually in our freezer.
And I guess if you don't have venison, you could use beef, right?
This stew is better with venison. I think beef doesn't quite – I'm not sure I would do beef with dates, but I'd have to think about that. Although venison is now – I mean, one of the conceits of this book was that I collected most of the recipes, and then I sent them to my co-author, Danielle Crittenden, who lives in Washington. And she then cooked them. And the test was, can we cook this in the United States? And are all the ingredients we need present, and can I buy them at my local supermarket? And she discovered that, yes, you could. There was quite a lot of frozen venison around in her supermarket in the middle of Washington, D.C. So if she can do it, then it can be done. It's a wonderful meat because, of course, it's organic. And it's
yes,
about as organic
exactly
as you can possibly get.
And it's lean and it's utterly delicious. Anne, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Political journalist Anne Applebaum is co-author of From a Polish Country House Kitchen. Try her recipe for that iconic sour bread soup. This is definitely a one-of-a-kind dish, and it's really intriguing to make. So find sour bread soup on the website, splendidtable.org. There's a real cocktail revival going on in Kansas City, Missouri. And there's a backstory. During Prohibition, this city, also known as the Paris of the Plains, was famous for its cocktails. There was a sort of nod and wink attitude toward the drinking ban. But once Prohibition was repealed, the Kansas City cocktail scene just faded away. Until recently, the brilliant cocktail is coming back, and many bartenders are getting inspiration from those golden Prohibition days. Except for the one man who's looking overseas instead. Russell Newlove tracked him down.
When bar manager Scott Beskow was drawing up his cocktail menu to complement the Austrian food served at the Grunauer restaurant in Kansas City, Missouri, he hit upon a small problem.
They don't really have a cocktail culture in Austria.
Kansas City, however, does. The burgeoning drink scene in the downtown arts district allowed Scott plenty of room for experimentation. At the top of the current drinks list is Der Schmutzige, the dirty one.
And it really is basically built off of the idea of the dirty martini, which is base spirit and olive juice. We just realized that we had a ton of kraut juice. We had a ton of pickle water. The beet brine, we actually make that for the drink, but two of the three parts of the constituents of the brine are from the kitchen. So that just adds a little, it still stays with the briny, salty thing, but it also adds in kind of an earthiness from the kraut, the sweetness from the beets. And then mustard and black pepper are two of the spices that the kitchen uses a lot, obviously. So we took mustard flour and peppercorns and put that in vodka and let it sit. Doesn't take long. Pickle needs to be cold. The drink needs to be extremely cold. Not that it's not good. It certainly still tastes good when it warms up, but the colder the better, at least for that first sip.
Scott slides a martini glass over to me. Honestly, given the list of ingredients is heavy on things like brine and kraut, I was expecting it to look a bit like, well, bathwater, but a little more elegant. Instead, I'm presented with something violet, more cosmopolitan than martini, a result of the sweet beet juice, slightly opaque with a huge wedge of pickle on the rim. It's a decidedly aromatic drink, the mustard spices and pepper filling the nose rather than the mouth, and yes, it's an acquired taste.
And it is one of the drinks that I tell people when they order it. One, make sure that you like everything that's listed, and two, it's a love or hate drink. So some people come, they crave it, they come in for it. Other people try it and don't like it, and you know, we're more than happy to replace it. I like to prefer people to try something a little bit outside their comfort zone, but if you don't like kraut, beets, mustard, pepper, pickles, definitely not the drink for you.
But yet I keep going back for more, just to make sure that, yes, I did taste it right, and yes, it does taste like pickle, and yes, I would drink it again, though probably not in the same sitting. Appetite fully whetted, we move on to dessert.
Flüssiger Strudel means liquid strudel, so it's really an intention to approximate the delicious strudel that our chef de cuisine makes. The crust for the strudel takes a while to prepare, so the first thing he does is he peels and cores the apples and slices them, and then they get rolled in sugar, cinnamon, and they sit, and just in that process of sitting with the sugar, the juice drains off, and so he's left with a cider syrup, or it's almost what it tastes like. It's just apple juice, sugar, cinnamon, but that sweetness of that item is balanced out by a squeeze of fresh lemon, so it's not it doesn't end up being like a cloyingly sweet drink. It also has Gosling's dark rum, and then a dash of old-fashioned bitters, which have a cinnamon and clove, and then egg whites, which basically further kind of round it out. They create like a meringue texture. They sort of make it airy, and that takes any of the additional sharp edges of the flavors and makes it really mellow. And then it creates a really beautiful froth on the top of the drink, and we kind of dash that with some Hungarian cinnamon and swirl it with a swizzle. It looks really good. It's really pretty. And then it drinks really smooth and tastes like a liquid strudel. So
ice.
This one needs a really good long shake. Really want to get the egg whites to do their magic and give it a real airy, delicious texture.
This actually looks like a dessert. Scott flicks the nutmeg through the foam, much like a barista would with the crema on an espresso, so the glass looks like it's holding a soft, velvety cupcake. And it tastes like Christmas, all baked apples and cinnamon. These cocktails might not conform to the classic canon, but Scott explains that they do their intended job and will complement anything you eat at Grunauer.
We didn't want to be untrue to the flavors and make things that didn't tie in with the cuisine. In fact, they're made from byproducts of the cooking process. So they're literally and figuratively tied in with the food, I guess.
Scott Beskow is the bar manager of Grunauer's Wunderbar in Kansas City, Missouri. Russell Newlove is a freelance radio journalist who specializes in food and drink. Now, we're going to be back with the seeds to plant this spring for instant gratification. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. No country takes gardening as seriously as England does. And the UK's rock star of herbs is Jekka McVicar. Now, 20 years ago, when the only green herb in a British supermarket was parsley, Jekka started selling herbs from her backyard. Now she has the largest herb collection in the UK, and she and her nursery are institutions. She's the author of Jekka's Herb Cookbook, and she joins us from her kitchen. Jekka, it's really good to have you with us again.
It's wonderful to be back. It's been far too long.
You know, we're coming to you for some inspiration for spring planting.
Well, I can't wait for spring to come. I don't know if what the weather's like with you, but it's been fairly awful here in the UK. And one of the best things to grow in spring, which really inspires me, are the what I call the salad herbs, because they're so quick and so rewarding. And the fact you can actually create and eat your own produce within 28 days of sowing is just fantastic. And one of them, which I really love, is mustard, because you can get all these different coloured leaves, you can get all the different coloured flavours, and it is such a fantastic plant because you can add it to stir-fry dishes, you can add it to salads, you can really make your packs, sandwiches zing when you go to work. And ones to look out for are there's, here in the UK, we've got Red Frills mustard, and I'm sure you'll have it over in the States, and also a yellow mustard. And the Red Frills mustard, it starts off tasting sort of rather like new potatoes.
Oh, really?
And then it goes and blows your head off. So it's really, really versatile. But you can get red leaves, green leaves, and yellow leaves, and round leaves, serrated leaves, but they're all mustard-flavored. So you can actually also now buy mixed mustard leaf seed. Just like the cut-and-come-again salads, you treat it in exactly the same way. So what you do is you either get a large pot, and when I mean a large pot, I mean a pot the size of a tomato, what you grow your tomatoes in, or a little trough or a raised bed or whatever you like, and you prepare your ground well. The soil, remember, is the engine of any garden. So if you're using a potting compost, use a good potting compost, the best you can buy. Don't skimp, because that's a waste of your money of buying the seeds. And if you're preparing your ground, prepare it well. Do you know how to know if the soil is warm enough for you to sow? Do you know how to check the soil's warm?
No.
Well, what you have to do is you have to take your knickers down and sit on the soil. And if it's warm enough, then you'll know. But obviously, if you have an allotment, you can't go around doing that kind of thing.
Well, if you have a window box, it's kind of hard, too. It gets difficult.
So what you do is you stick your elbow in, because your elbow is much more sensitive than your hands, because your hands, when you're doing washing up, just like you're checking
so
a baby's bath.
So if it feels comfortable to your elbow,
exactly.
The soil's warm enough for you to plant.
Yeah.
Huh.
Because if you think about it, what seeds need is warmth, light, and water to germinate. And if your seed's too cold, the seed will say, don't like this, and close down. And the other thing is watering and feeding. If you're in a pot, do not let your compost dry out.
Okay.
Because that will make the leaves tough and bitter. And because the sun now is so intense, a bit of partial shade is really good from the midday sun. I actually do grow my mustards in semi-shade. And another top tip is water before you go to work, not when you come home.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, that's very logical. You need to give it a good watering, it's a hot day, it stops it drying out. Whereas if you water when you come home, the temperatures drop at night, your plants sit there sulking.
And they're going to probably rot.
Yeah, quite often they do.
How do you fertilize?
Right, I use a liquid feed, and here on the nursery, we feed on Fridays. F for food, F for Friday, F for feed. And that way I remember, because if you're like me, you're always writing lists. So I have to have rhymes to make me remember things. And so that's one of my rhymes. And but I use a liquid fertilizer that's made from seaweed, because it's actually not, in true sense, a fertilizer. It is a tonic. It's like you taking multivitamins. And it's absolutely fantastic for any salad herbs because it gives it its minerals and its vitamins, and it grows beautifully.
So it's seaweed.
And it stops it growing too fast. If you give something high nitrogen,
right,
what you're doing is it's like giving a teenager alcohol, and you know how stupid they get. Well, it's exactly the same with the plant. It goes, oh, wow, and you go, and it grows too sore, too soft, and then keels over. So the great thing is to make sure that you, you know, literally give it this tonic, and then it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And the great way to keep them going is to keep trimming them. You know, keep cutting. That way you'll inhibit flowering. Once it goes to flower, it does become a bit tough.
Jekka, thank you. I'm inspired by mustard at this point. Thank you.
Excellent.
Herb expert Jekka McVicker is the author of Jekka's Herb Cookbook. And by the way, congratulations are in order. The venerable Chelsea Flower Show, now in its 100th year, has finally deemed to name a woman as chairperson of all judges. And that woman is Jekka McVicker. Find Jekka's mustard leaf sauce recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, for a completely different side of what can happen when you plant seeds, we're going to turn to our friends at the Perennial Plate. Now, the perennialplate.com could give you wanderlust really fast, at least if you're curious about food. The Perennial Plate duo, that's Chef Daniel Klein and camerawoman Mira Fine, find their ways into home kitchens, onto farms and fishing boats, and they have a goal, 12 countries in depth in 18 months. Well, they've just returned from India, and Mira and Daniel join me in the studio, and Daniel has their story. Mira, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
So you were in India, and I understand that while you were there, you discovered a woman who's become very famous as a seed saver. What's the story here?
Well, when we found out that we were going to India, we obviously do some research, and something that continued to come up in our research was these stories of farmer suicides in India.
Farmer suicides?
Yeah, it's this horrible occurrence. With the last 15 years, there have been over 200,000 farmers who have killed themselves in India. There are varying opinions on why they are doing it, but a lot of it's due to debt, losing their land. And one of the big reasons that people claim is because they have to buy seeds, and they used to never have to buy seeds. And so there's this sort of phenomenon by which the old culture of India and of the world really is you're a farmer, so you save seeds and you use them again the next year.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's a perennial thing. You are able to hold on to what you grow. So as culture changed and companies came in and began to sell seeds instead, traditional seeds were taken out of society and farmers were sold patented seeds that they could not save anymore. So
uh-huh.
Because they're patented, you can't use them again. You have to buy them year after year. And so instead of having this free source, they were forced to buy. So farmers took on more debt and more debt and eventually
uh-huh.
lost their land, had shame brought on them. And the way most of these farmers committed suicide is actually to go into the field and drink a bottle of pesticide. So it's really heavy stuff.
Yes.
And, but the sort of the positive reaction to this catastrophe is this concept of seed saving, getting these seeds that were lost back into the culture of India. And so there's this Dr. Vandana Shiva, who's a very charismatic and recognized woman, but also quite controversial,
uh-huh.
and that she's made it her sort of life mission to defeat Monsanto in India, which mm-hmm. Monsanto is a chemical and seed company, and promote an alternative to sort of industrial agriculture. And so she, with her partner Bija means seed in Hindi, so it's quite interesting that the woman who actually runs this seed organization has that in her name.
Interesting.
They worked together and started off with just saving a few varieties of rice, and now they have over 2,000 varieties of rice. Rice is the central thing, but they also collect vegetable varieties from around India as well.
And these are what we might call heirloom seeds?
Yeah, they're heirloom seeds. They're original seeds. They're seeds that are developed by farmers by taking, you know, you have a rice crop, and right. some of the rice grows better than the other rice. And so you hang on to the good seeds, and you save the ones that are strong and the ones that held up to the drought. So they have value. There's thousands of years of history built into these individual seeds. And it has unbelievable positive ramifications. Like when the tsunami came and hit the eastern side of India, farmers couldn't grow their crops because the salt had come into the land.
Yeah.
But because of the seed saving, there were varieties of rice that were resilient to salt. And so they were able to reintroduce these seeds, and that flourished in this sort of these circumstances.
So are many farmers using these seeds now? I mean, has this become something that's a new movement in India?
You know, it would still be a small percentage of farmers that were using these alternative, or I guess they're the original seeds.
Right.
There are like bastions of, like in Dehradun where we visited, it's the part of India known for growing the best rice. It's certainly a growing movement, but you're not going to see it everywhere, and you don't hear people talking about it. Unless it affects you, you're not really going to know about it. There's one beautiful story that we encountered in our stay with at the Seed Saving Center, which is the woman Bija, who runs the operation. She told us about how she was passing on this tradition to her children, and what she did was with her children and the kids of the neighborhood, she had them each plant a seed. And then they, instead of having some other competition, they have this idea of whose plant is growing the most. And so each child has this ownership over this heirloom seed that they've taken care of over a period of years and seeing their tree grow. So it's giving them this sense of, like, belonging to the land. It's really a beautiful thing.
And it's a tree, not something that grows in months, but something that grows over years.
Right.
Yeah. Wonderful story. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks for having us on.
Daniel Klein is creator of theperennialplate.com. Now, for more information on his seed story, go to the website, splendidtable.org.
I got a little girl, got a baker's shop. Daddy rolls the high things he got. Yes, the baker's shop boogie. Yes, the baker's shop boogie. Yes, the baker's shop boogie is the nicest thing in town. All right, let's boogie some.
Savannah's back-in-the-day bakery is definitely vintage land. That imagined comfort zone, the 1940s and 50s, complete with period-flowered tablecloths and old-time aprons. Those were the years when baking from scratch was a badge of honor. You look in the bakery cases and you'd think you were at a community bake sale maybe 60 years ago. Cheryl and Griffith Day made this all happen. She does the sweets, he does the breads, and together they've written the Back in the Day Bakery Cookbook. Cheryl, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. What qualifies as a vintage dessert?
You know, that's a great question. I think anything that reminds us of a sweeter, simpler time. I think it's different for everybody, but I think cupcakes are the all-American dessert. Anything that you kind of long for that reminds you of, you know, yesteryear. That's how I qualify it. And always things made from scratch. And it's just so wonderful now to kind of see this renaissance of people wanting to learn more about time-honored traditions and professions in general from the past. And fortunately, baking is at the forefront of that.
Well, we've seen the cupcake craze, and I don't think
yes.
the chocolate chip cookie is ever going out of style.
Never.
But what do you see coming up? What's going to be next as being, you know, the next big vintage dessert to really hit?
I really am into pies right now. I think the craft of making a pie has made a comeback, and it's just something that no matter what your skill level is, you can make a pie, and who doesn't enjoy a slice of pie? And I think it's definitely going to be, you know, coming forward.
Well, you heard it here first.
I love pie.
I think, you know, pie and cake, those two words, if you just say them and think about them, they're so alluring.
It's true. And layer cakes, old-fashioned layer cakes.
Oh, yeah.
I think My grandmother used to call them celebration cakes.
I think about that pleasure you get as a baker of taking that one layer and you frosted the first one and you gently ease the second layer on.
It does. I really have the best job.
Yeah. But you have got, now this is something I wanted to get into, to talk about some of the favorite recipes in the books, evidently some of the really big sellers. And
yes. And
you use some techniques that are really interesting to me. And one of them is you have this chocolate heaven cake.
Yes.
Which is your chocolate layer cake with the buttercream frosting. But you do things in that cake recipe that you don't normally see. For instance, number one, you tell people to put all of the dry ingredients into the mixing bowl of a mixer.
Correct.
And then run the mixer for like 3 minutes.
Right.
Now, what are you doing? Why are you doing that?
Well, here's the thing. When Griff and I wrote the book, we longed for a book like this. We wanted a book that didn't feel like a textbook, but still really went into the science of baking. So we wanted to give all the details, all those little details that maybe your grandmother may have done that you may not have noticed. And these are the things that made the difference and made a cake lighter. It's basically this particular recipe is an alternative to sifting flour. This is just another way to aerate your flour and get that light, fluffy texture in the cake.
Okay, so the next step in this cake, because this cake really fascinates me, and you say this is the one chocolate cake that will make your life change.
It really is, and I've been making it since I was 8 years old. So
that's been tested.
It has been tested a long time.
Okay, so you mix those dry ingredients, and then you melt the chocolate, all 9 ounces of it, in 2 cups of coffee.
That's correct. That's what melts the chocolate. And it has to be really hot coffee. I will point that out.
That has to give the cake such an edge in
terms
of flavor.
It really does. It just really takes it to a whole other level.
Okay. Now there's one other step. Okay. There's sour cream in this recipe, right?
Yes.
And if I remember, is there oil in it or butter?
There's oil, actually. It's an old-fashioned retro cake. And back in the South, back in the day, pun intended,
right,
butter obviously was at a premium. So this recipe was made with oil. And again, it really makes it so moist.
But you whip together the oil and, as I remember, the eggs and sour cream.
Right. You kind of emulsify, basically, the eggs and the oil. So you get this light texture with the eggs, and then you add the sour cream, and that's going to, add moisture again.
And then all you have to do is put that all into the bowl with the dry ingredients, and you're there?
Easy. I think the biggest problem a lot of amateur bakers or home bakers have is that a lot of cookbooks, unless, like I said, it's a technical textbook or something like that, they assume that you know what creaming butter and sugar means. And that is the biggest thing that you need to learn, the biggest technique. You know, it makes or break your cookies, your cakes, and, everything in baking. So this recipe, the chocolate cake, I think is foolproof.
Well, Cheryl, thanks for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Cheryl Day is co-author with her husband, Griffith Day, of the Back in the Day Bakery Cookbook. Do try her chocolate heaven cake with chocolate buttercream. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
I'm in the phone booth. It's a one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just ring it off the wall. I know he's there, but I just try to call.
Don't leave me hanging on the telephone. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone.
Well, pick up that phone. Call us, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Twan is on the phone calling from France. Hi, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I would like to talk about bringing a piece of American food to France. I was chosen to go study abroad in France, and they placed me in this little dorm with a little kitchen that doesn't have an oven, fortunately. But I want your advice on making comfort food, American comfort food, in France.
Okay. Well, so you're studying in France? What are you studying?
Yes. I am studying French language, for one.
Good thing to study when you go to France, right?
Right. But a little bit of culinary arts on the side here. And that's sort of why I'm calling you.
Oh, that's fun.
Yes. So I've dabbled a little bit with different things. Like, for one, macaroni and cheese,
right.
I think, is a very good American tradition.
Right.
So I wanted your advice on what cheeses might be good to use.
Oh, you're in cheese heaven. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, it's sort
exactly.
of
it's almost overwhelming.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if the people who originally thought of macaroni and cheese in the United States had been in France, this dish mm-hmm. would have always been mm-hmm. completely different. Well, mm-hmm. one of the classic cheeses to go into mac and cheese is Gruyere. Yeah, but the other thing I would do, which would be kind of fun, would be to do Gruyere and then do one of the really, really lovely aged cheeses like Beaufort, B-E-A-U-F-O-R-T. I think it's from the Savoie region, you know,
okay.
which is southern France, but way over to the east. It's mountain mm-hmm. country. The other thing is, and also, you know, it could be even that orange Mimolet cheese, which would be wonderful, mixed with the
green. Which cheese is it?
Mimolet, Mimolette, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, the other thing to think about is you could do, instead of the Gruyere, okay, you could do one of those harder cheeses, firmer cheeses that taste really nutty, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, as a contrast, pick a fresh cheese, like a fromage frais. Now,
okay.
this will mean you will have to go to a cheese store and taste many cheeses to
okay.
see if you. This is going to be very hard work, Tuan.
I think
somebody
would be very comfortable with that.
I think you sound like you would be. But seriously, what you want is something that's a bit on the creamy side, very bright and fresh, with then a cheese that's aged. It's a harder cheese. It's very nutty and mellow, and it's a base. You know, one is this kind of creamy, dancy little thing, and the other one is this robust thing. And you could do more cheeses. I mean, a little creamy goat cheese could go in there, too. Or you could add a bit of a camembert, that kind of thing. You know, that one of the rind cheeses, the bloomy rind cheeses, too, because they have that wonderful funk.
And all of these cheeses melt pretty easily.
Oh, all of them do. All of them do. And since you don't have an oven, you can do the mac and cheese on top of the stove.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and one of the things that you can do, normally it's done with a bechamel sauce, you know, where you do melted butter and flour and you cook that together with a whisk
okay.
and a saucepan. And then you, after you've done that for about 4 or 5 minutes and there's no taste of raw flour, then you add hot milk. You whisk that in a little at a time so there's no lumps. And you let that simmer. And when it thickens up after about 5-7 minutes, you can season that with nutmeg and salt and pepper.
Now, very good.
Another way, and that's a great way to do it. And you just, and the proportions are usually, if you have a 1/2 pound of pasta, right?
Okay.
Then you would have probably, you want 1/4 cup of flour, 1/4 cup of butter, all right? And then you want to have about 3 cups of milk.
3 cups of milk. Very
yeah.
good.
2 to 3 cups of milk will do it.
Do you recommend a certain type of milk? Because what I found over here is they have a different type of milk that I think they reduce the amount of lactose in it.
Well, that
they actually keep it outside.
Yeah, and yeah, because it's the milk that's been treated so that it's. I personally like fresh milk. I don't like the taste of that of that milk, but it's used a lot because you don't have a lot of refrigeration sometimes.
Right,
but I like
right.
fresh milk, and what I would do is I do half milk and half cream.
Half milk and half cream.
Yeah,
very good.
And then what I do is stir in the cheeses, stir in the cooked pasta, let that cook together a little bit, and then if you want to, you can do butter toasted crackers or breadcrumbs with a little garlic in them, and you put the cheese in the bowl, and then you top it with the crispy butter, garlicky breadcrumbs.
Excellent.
And I think you'll have five comfort up the kazoo.
Thank
okay?
you so much.
You enjoy.
drink this experience in.
Absolutely.
It's going to be, yeah. I know it can be tough sometimes, but boy, it's also pretty swell. Enjoy, okay?
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care, Duan. Bye. Stovetop mac and cheese. You know what I forgot to tell him about that mac and cheese? The French were doing mac and cheese back in the 1600s and 1400s. They but it was done with nuts and cinnamon and cream and cheeses and pasta. And it was royalty food. I mean, it was the food of nobility. Enough already. Okay, 800-537-5252 or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Denise is on the phone from Claremont, California. Hey, Denise, what's on your mind?
Hello, Lynn. I was calling because I'm hoping you can help my husband and I out with some tips on making fried basil leaves. This summer, we went on a bike trip through the Piemonte region of Italy, and we went to a restaurant the first night we were there, Trattoria della Posta, and in the town of Monforte d'Alba, and the chef, it was just a trattoria, but he still offered a little amuse-bouche.
Right.
And it was
a little thing to keep you going while you're reading the menu.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. God forbid you should be hungry.
And it was the most perfect little fried basil leaf, but it had a coating on it that we just haven't been able to reproduce. We tried a kind of a batter that was too heavy. It was like egg and some flour in it.
Right.
And that was too heavy. And so then we did flour with egg with flour, but that was still too heavy.
Right.
This was just, it was so light. It was almost, the basil leaf was almost transparent. It was like a green gold, and it was just perfect.
I've had fried basil leaves, but often just, you know, dropped in the oil. Fried really fast and then tossed with salt, not with a batter. But you know what I'm wondering? I wonder if it's something like a tempura batter.
Well, I was going to get a tempura mix because I thought it's rice flour, right, that they use for
Not necessarily. No, not necessarily. It can be flour and water with just a bit, like, not super thick.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes with an egg yolk, sometimes not. And salt and pepper, and then you fold in beaten egg white.
Oh.
If I'm remembering right. And if I'm not, that is, whether it's Japanese or not, one kind of batter that you can use for deep frying. And the idea is that you dip the leaf in there, let most of it drain off, and then it goes right into the hot oil.
Okay, so
That's one way. Another way is panko breadcrumbs, where you dip the leaf in just beaten egg,
mm-hmm.
right, that's seasoned, and then you roll it in those panko breadcrumbs, and they're, you know, from Japan. You can get them now in a lot of stores, not just Asian stores. And those breadcrumbs have a little bit of oil in them, and they make for extra crunch. Now, that may not be exactly what you had, but a light coating of that on a basil leaf could be really delicious.
Thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye. By the way, the idea of biking through the Piedmont region of northern Italy. This is the northwestern region, and it's famous for Barolo and Barresco wines. And the food there, because it's mountain country mainly, is lusty and rich. It's beef country, and it's the area where you get incredible potatoes. I mean, there's the pastas and everything else. And the restaurant where they were in Monforte, the town of Monforte, you can't eat badly in the town of Monforte. And the region is called the Langhe, the northern region where the wines are, the part of the region, because there are these ridges that come out from the mountainsides that look like tongues, and lung is tongue. So anyway, it's a wonderful place to visit, and it's primo wine country. Call us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. I've got a dining tip. In a good Chinese restaurant, asking if they have chicken feet is one way to convince your waiter that you don't want to eat the stuff they make only for Americans. And I guarantee once you get over the idea of chicken feet, the taste is going to blow you away, in a good way. The lower portion of a beast's anatomy has been snubbed far, far too long. British food writer Hazel Ann Williams is working on a comeback of dining on the lower extremities. She's blogged about soul food, S-O-L-E, recently on the Guardian website. Hazel Ann, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, look, this is really not an easy sell. I mean, to talk to people about eating the feet of an animal. Why did you decide to do this piece?
I decided to do it because cowfoot stew, in particular, is what I talk about in the article, is a dish that I grew up on, and it's really lovely and tasty. But in my regular day-to-day life, working the busy life of a journalist, I really only eat salads and sandwiches and pasta. But I've decided to cook my more traditional dishes because they're delicious, really, and I have given up on them, unfortunately.
Right, right. Now, you're in the midst, you're in London, right, and you're in England, and this is where the nose-to-tail movement began, this idea of eating the entire animal. Is that influencing people a great deal in terms of how they see, for instance, eating feet?
Being specifically based in London, it's incredibly multicultural, and you can get anything you want, which is brilliant. So we do have a lot of different immigrants, like my grandparents who were Jamaican, and they ate feet. But what I've come to realize is that feet and nose to tail, and like in South Africa, I think they call them walkies and smileys, is really a really, really traditional dish that is eaten all around the world. But it's a culinary dish that's really been forgotten in modern metropolitan societies. But the great thing about London being so multicultural is that you do have a demand for such dishes from people who are coming over from Africa or Vietnam, who are still used to eating traditional dishes.
Well, what about this traditional dish that you wrote about? It's what's the name of it again?
It's cowfoot stew.
And how is it done?
Well, I always get the butcher to chop up the cowfoots, and you can get 2 for £5 here, which is really quite cheap, actually. We stew it for a very long time and add some seasoning, such as pimentos and a little bit of bay leaf and onions and a lot of water, and it stews for quite a long time. And then at the end, you add butter beans and dumplings made with plain flour and water. And it's a really, really traditional Jamaican dish that's enjoyed with either rice and peas or my favorite mashed potatoes.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. When you stew the cow's foot that way, it melts in your mouth. It's just delicious,
yes.
Isn't it?
Just
now, you also talked about another culture where feet have become extremely popular, or maybe always were. China. Tell us about China.
Yeah. It was really interesting because before I started to write the article, I didn't realize how prevalent feet were around the world. But in China is the country where they spend the most a year on chicken feet, and they were at one time one of the biggest exports from the U.S. because in the U.S. There were companies that had to dispose of feet. It was this part of the animal that had to be disposed of, but instead it was being shipped to China, and it was a multi-billion pound a year industry, and it still is, although there have been some trade disputes. But it's a snack. It's a accompaniment. It's used in soups. It's used as a standalone dish, like a sweet and sour. There's so many different variations, especially in China, where they use chicken feet. In Jamaican cooking, we do also in our soups, but nowhere near to the enormity that they do in China.
That's fascinating. You're saying it's one of the largest selling foods in China?
It's one of the most popular, and actually chicken feet cost more than actual chicken breasts.
Huh.
In China. So it's very, very popular.
Well, I know. I mean, I've had it in stews and in dim sum, and they're delicious. They've been braised in a wonderful sauce, and sometimes they're fried, and they're delicious. I had no idea of the popularity in China.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I think they refer to them as phoenix claws. So I'm not sure if it's got some kind of traditional mythical link to a phoenix, why it's so popular. That could be one of the reasons.
You know, I think if we could come up with a romantic name for cow's feet and pig's feet,
yeah.
that is something like that, probably they would become far more popular, no matter what the culture.
Yes, probably.
Hazel Ann, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Hazel Ann Williams is a British entertainment writer who blogs for The Guardian. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought. A lesson in sustainability. Pig's feet. How to eat closer to the ground. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now take a look at splendidtable.org for more information on anything you heard here today. You can check out our latest ebooks, podcasts, rifle through our recipe box, and register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.